This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up on Africa News Tonight...
Human rights groups accuse the government of carrying out a years-long campaign of intimidation and repression against potential political opponents and their supporters, including arrests and alleged kidnappings.
That's Zach Badoff reporting from Kigali ahead of tomorrow's presidential election. We'll have the full story coming up. Also, a new report's been released on the status of security and justice in Kenya. A recent tentative agreement reached between Italy's prime minister, the head of Libya's UN-backed government of national accord, may be in jeopardy. And a Boko Haram militant attack in northeastern Nigeria leaves 6 people dead and 3 injured. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Rwanda goes to the polls tomorrow with President Paul Kagame widely expected to win a third term amid allegations that his government has sought to suppress dissent. 9 of the 11 registered political parties have endorsed the incumbent, but 2 other candidates are still in the race. Zach Badoff reports from Kigali.
More than 200,000 people attended the final pre-election rally for President Paul Kagame in the capital. Supporters danced in cheers for hours before the president even arrived to speak. They waved the red, white, and blue flag for the ruling party, the Rwandan Patriotic Front.
He's a freedom fighter. He has brought us peace, unity, and reconciliation.
Kagame says he is confident he will win a third term by a wide margin. In the last election in 2010, Kagame won 93% of the vote. Human rights groups accuse the government of carrying out a years-long campaign of intimidation and repression against potential political opponents and their supporters, including arrests and alleged kidnappings. A new government policy this year required presidential candidates to have their social media messages pre-approved by the Electoral Commission. The policy was reversed following international criticism. The Electoral Commission rejected 4 of the opposition candidates who filed paperwork to run this year. One of Kagame's 2 remaining challengers is Green Party candidate Frank Habineza. A Habineza rally earlier this week on the outskirts of Kigali attracted about 500 people. The low turnout was blamed on a government order forcing a change in location. Nearly half the crowd at Habineza's rally stood across the street. Away from the camera and prying ears, some supporters told VOA they are afraid to publicly support the opposition. This is the first time Habineza has run.
We look at government policies, whether something which is not going right, we criticize it, but also we give an alternative to that program, to that policy, but not individuals, because individuals come and go, but the government stays and the people stay.
Yet, Kagame has been in power since the end of the genocide in 1994, and a 2015 constitutional referendum, approved by 98% of voters, allowed him to seek a third term and potentially remain in power until 2034. But there are some calling for change. VOA caught up with the newly formed People's Salvation Movement at a meeting inside a gated house. With curtains drawn and doors shut, about 15 members of the People's Salvation Movement discussed the future of the organization. They are led by Diane Rigada. This 35-year-old accountant was among the presidential candidates disqualified this year. The Electoral Commission said Rigada had not submitted the required 600 signatures. She said she submitted more than twice that. Since the People's Salvation Movement is not a registered party, Rigada says they only meet in private.
It's terror of fear of the ruling party, fear of the state, where people get mistreated by our government, by the people in power.
Kagame says the environment is free and open. The spokesperson for the ruling RPF party, Weller's Gasamagera, told VOA that Kagame's opponents use arguments about human rights as an excuse for their lack of popular support.
We have a lot of associations, be it political associations, parties, I mean, be it simply civil society. Everything is open here.
Rwandans head to the polls Friday with results expected as soon as the weekend. Zach Bador for VOA News, Kigali.
Thank you, Zach, for an analysis of tomorrow's presidential election in Rwanda. Reporter Claude Kabengera in Kigali spoke with political analyst Dr. Christopher Kayumba. He's a researcher and an educator at the University of Rwanda. He spoke about the main issues the country faces and how they might influence the polls.
From what I have heard from candidates, I would divide what they consider to be important issues into 3 points. One is economic, the other is social welfare, and finally, democracy and rights. If you look at RPF, President Kagame is emphasizing job creation, investing in industries, infrastructure, and ensuring social welfare. On the other hand, his opponents are largely emphasizing cutting taxes. Secondly, both the Green Party candidate, Frank, and Mahimana are largely focusing on sustaining democracy, freedom of expression, freedom of association, and media freedom. But they're also talking about investing in security. And of course, one of the main problems I have found with all the presidential candidates is their lack of defining the key challenges the country faces. Even when they talk about poverty, what does poverty mean in Rwanda's context?
Do you think the opposition members have a chance of making gains?
I don't think the opposition, the two candidates, have the capacity to make gains. I don't think any of them will get more than 2% because of the way they have articulated the issues, the way they have organized these elections. They are little known in the political scene, but also because of their campaign strategies.
What do you think are the chances of success for the one authorized opposition party in Rwanda, the Democratic Green Party of Rwanda?
Whether or not the Green Party becomes the main opposition party is difficult to decide, because if you look at how power is structured at the moment, we would say that PSD would be the largest political party because it has the second majority in parliament. PL is the third majority in parliament. The only way the Green Party can be considered a major political party, it will be after the next year's parliamentary elections. That is when we can know its strength. But before that happens, we can't know.
Do you think the campaigning has so far been fair and transparent?
From everything I have seen, 3 things have happened. This time round, because candidates have been allowed to express themselves, have been also allowed to access the media, and their complaints have also been responded to by the Electoral Commission and local leaders, there is no way anybody can say that they haven't been given the chance to express themselves.
Presidential challengers Frank Habineza and Philippe Mahiman are both younger players on the political scene. Do they either look like they will pose a serious challenge to President Kagame?
There is no way. If we compare the people who have been to their campaigns, they are too few to tell us that they can in any way significantly affect the electoral outcome. Secondly, their articulation of the issues and how they suggest solving these challenges. But the way they have done this also leaves a lot to be desired. I wouldn't say that any of the opponents of the incumbent will get even more than 2%.
Do you see Rwanda evolving in the future to a multi-party state?
You know, because of the structure of the political system, and because there is also a forum for political parties, Rwanda is not a majoritarian electoral system. Where political parties are sharing power, you don't have that kind of adversarial. So I don't see that in the next 10 to 20 years, Rwanda will have a vocal opposition political party, because this is not what is in the constitution, but it is also something that the political elite do not want.
You have profound background in media. Do you feel that media is properly empowered by law to look at the issues and cover the elections well? Or are there impediments to covering the political scene?
If you look at the Constitution, Article 34, it empowers the media. The electoral law, it empowers the media. If you look at the media law of 2013, even access to information law, all these laws empower the media. So the challenge with the media are not located in law, not even in the number of media outlets. The challenge have to do with the capacity of media outlets, both intellectual capacity, but also financial abilities. Being able to cover all the candidates is very expensive, but also the ability to analyze these manifestos, what candidates are talking in terms of the nature of the economy and the nature of development is not something that is easy.
That was Dr. Christopher Kayumba, a political analyst. He spoke with reporter Claude Kabengera in Kigali. Al-Shabaab militants are blamed for an attack on a northern Kenya police station that killed one officer. The Associated Press reports the attack occurred early this morning in Mandera County at the Lafi police station. Two vehicles were also set on fire. The Somalia-based Al-Shabaab has been stepping up assaults ahead of Kenya's elections next week and has threatened to disrupt the elections themselves. 3 days ago, three people were killed in an attack in southern Kenya. Al-Shabaab is also suspected in that incident. 10 years after Kenya's post-election violence that left more than 1,000 people dead, a new report's been released on the status of security and justice in the country. The report is a joint effort by the International Federation for Human Rights in Paris and the Kenyan Human Rights Commission. It's entitled Kenya's Scorecard on Security and Justice, Broken Promises and Unfinished Business. George Kagoro is the executive director of the commission. From Nairobi, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua first about the status of security reforms in Kenya.
It's negative. We've had challenges about terrorism and terrorist-related threats, and then the responses that we've made to those threats. So we have the problem of insecurity from terrorism that we have not managed to completely address. And then when we also deal with that, we deal with it in a manner that itself undermines human rights in counterterrorism measures.
Would you explain further in that regard, what measures do you feel are violating human rights in the war against terrorists?
We have had levels of profiling of people based on religion, based on physical appearance. The worst aspects of that happened in 2015 with the operation that was carried in Nairobi, where members of the Somali community were bussed into a stadium and put through a security screening, and the basis on which that happened was entirely their physical appearance. But that has not ended there, because we've had in the recent past security operations in the northeastern part of the country, which is the Kenyan-Somali neighborhoods, where again we've had mass graves that have not been explained so clearly. The security agents are active in that part of the country. There are killings going on, and we don't know the basis on which those killings are going on. And then, of course, the fact that people are then buried in mass graves means that there's an attempt to cover up the fact that the killings have happened in the first place.
Now, of course, you began your work following the 2007-2008 post-election violence. Have you seen any improvements in regards to preventing such violence in the upcoming election?
This election is a replica of the 2007 election. We have got an incumbent versus a challenger situation. Every time we've had an incumbent versus a challenger situation in Kenya's recent electoral history, we've had some violence emanating from just that situation. Secondly, we have a very polarized political context in which all sides of the political divide, the main sides of the political actors in this country, have got very strongly entrenched positions against each other. But in addition to that, you've got a significant amount of belligerence that has been coming from the government side in relation to the campaigns that they've carried out recently. That is completely unusual. In Kenya's electoral history, the government has not been this belligerent in campaigns. This particular election is remarkable because of levels of belligerence that they've shown in the way they interact with the population in the campaigns. And that is something that worries. That is also something that shows that somewhere down the line, this campaign has stopped being a democratic exercise where one or the other party can win and the opposite party losing, and has become very much a power struggle. It feels as though the government side is no longer interested in winning an election. It is more interested in retaining power. So this is what this campaign boils down to in the recent 2 to 5 days.
What would you like to see happen between now and Election Day to help prevent any violence?
To leave the Electoral Commission alone. They've had the death that happened against a key official that is in charge of the preparations. Chris Msando was the ICT director. We would like assurances that the commission is safe and is not going to be the subject of political pressure that seeks to undermine the results one way or the other. So we would like an assurance that it is still an electoral contest rather than a power struggle between the two sides. And that is something that can only come from the president's side, showing that they're interested in an election rather than retaining power at all costs.
Now, the report also looks at reforms in the judiciary sector. How much progress has been made there?
It's been many steps forward, a few steps back, so it's a mixed picture.
George Kagoro is the executive director of the Kenyan Human Rights Commission. From Nairobi, he spoke with VOA's Joe DiCapua. The UN says Somalia's severe drought is expected to deepen until the start of October's dear rainy season. That means no improvement is expected in food security or nutrition in some parts of the country for the rest of the year. 6.7 million people need assistance. Nearly half are listed as being in crisis or emergency conditions. More than 360,000 children under age 5 are acutely malnourished. Nearly 72,000 cases of acute watery diarrhea and cholera have been reported. Nearly 1,100 people have died of the diseases. Drought has displaced 766,000 people in Somalia since last October. A recent tentative agreement reached between Italy's prime minister and Fayez al-Sarraj, the head of Libya's UN-backed government of national accord, may be in jeopardy. That proposal calls for Italian naval vessels to patrol Libyan waters to curb the flow of migrants and crack down on human traffickers. However, a rival to the Libyan prime minister opposes the plan, Field Marshal Khalifa Haftar, who commands Libya's so-called National Army, has ordered naval bases in four Libyan cities to block Italian ships. Also, Libya's parliament, which supports Haftar, has voiced strong opposition to the plan. Reporter Josephine McKenna is following developments and updates us on the situation.
It's unlikely that the Libyan parliament will keep the Italian vessels out of their area. The parliament, based in eastern Libya, has warned that such a move would be exporting the illegal migration crisis to Libya by sending migrants stopped at sea back to their country. But the parliament also criticised the Tripoli-based government of Prime Minister Fayez Sarraj for striking this deal with the Italians in the first place. So what you see here is a very divided Libya, and that was also reinforced when the country's military strongman, General Khalifa Haftar, who controls most of eastern Libya, threatened to use his own forces to repel the Italians, to possibly attack the Italians if they came into Libyan water. This is really a very complex situation at the moment.
And why does Italy want to put their vessels there?
Well, Italy feels that this action is needed to support the Tripoli-based government of Sarraj to try and stop the flow, the massive flow of migrants we've seen. We've had around 95,000 migrants arrive in Italy just this year. This is action to really stop the people smugglers and stop this flow of migrants, which really shows no sign of slowing down.
What is the EU doing right now to try to help with the migrant situation?
The Italians have been complaining for some time that the European Union is not doing enough to support Italy. For this reason, it seems Italy is strengthening its own action, really has done quite a bit already to train and support the Libyan Coast Guard. This takes it to another level by deploying at least two ships to the area. It's just unclear what would happen if there was some sort of confrontation between Libyan forces and the Italians, or between the Italians and any migrants. So the rules of engagement here are very unclear at this point.
Another major development, I understand, is the Italian police seizing an NGO vessel vessel. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, this is big news. The Italian authorities seized the Juventa, a vessel operated by the German Jugendrettet organization, an NGO that has been rescuing migrants. The NGO is accused of aiding illegal immigration. The boat has been impounded. The prosecutors have also released very damaging photographs showing some sort of meeting between the vessel and people smugglers in the Mediterranean as migrants are being rescued. Now, prosecutors said there was no evidence of a conspiracy, a criminal organization, but they simply said there was evidence of these encounters and contact. That's very damaging for this NGO, and it's unclear whether this is a political move or really justified in terms of its judicial nature, but it's certainly going to change the nature of rescues in the Mediterranean. There's been a huge outcry on social media about this, and we're waiting to hear more from the Italian authorities on how they will proceed.
And overall, just how are migrants faring once they do reach the Italian coastline?
Well, there is a lot in the media about overcrowding in the migrant centres, more pressure on local councils across the country. We still have thousands of migrants arriving all the time, every day, and we've seen a slight fall in the numbers in July, but overall the numbers coming this year are still really quite enormous, and there's concern that this year we'll have a record number of migrants landing in Italy. People here are really worried that they just can't deal with the influx because there's so much pressure on social services.
That was reporter Josephine McKenna speaking to us from Rome. You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Well, there has been yet another attack by Boko Haram militants in northeastern Nigeria, leaving 6 people dead, 3 others were injured. AFP quotes an Adamawa state official as saying Boko Haram attacked the village of Mildu in the far north yesterday. Several homes and shops were set on fire. The official says gunmen came in large numbers and fought with security personnel. It's thought the attackers came from the nearby Sambisa Forest, which had been a stronghold of Boko Haram. The government has launched several offensives to clear the forest of the militants. A South African man who had been held for 6 years by Islamic extremists in Mali has been freed. The Associated Press reports Stephen McGowan was released on Saturday and is back home. He had been abducted in Timbuktu in 2011 by Al-Qaeda's North African branch. He had been traveling as a tourist and had dual South African and British citizenship. In early July, the extremist group had released a proof-of-life video that featured McGowan and 5 other foreign hostages. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
This is a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
Did you know that more than 1.6 million people acquired HIV, the virus that causes AIDS, in recent years? More than half of those infected were under 24 and most of them were young girls. You can protect yourself from HIV. If you're a man, use a condom every time you have sex. If you're a woman, insist that your partner use a condom. And whether you're a man or a woman, talk to your health provider about an HIV test.
That was a message in the public interest from VOA Africa.
VOAAfrica.com.
News, features, music from Africa and around the world. You want it? We have it on VOAAfrica.com.
VOAAfrica.com.
All day, all night.